Cloud agnosticism, or as many people have started referring to it lately as multi-cloud. So you sit down and start writing some code, as you do, ideally wearing a tie, as I do. And now you want to take that application that you've built and you want to deploy it to Google Cloud Platform and to AWS and to Microsoft Azure and to Oracle Cloud. They have lawyers. I dare not use their logo, so I found some clip art instead. So you deploy it to all four of those clouds, and what happens? It catches fire! And your SREs, you try and do the responsible thing and put it out. Great move. Now you're on fire. And then you talk to me about it. Now I'm on fire. Which leads us to a great segue. Who am I? My name's Corey Quinn. I do a lot of things, including cloud economics, but mostly I spend time raising my daughter and teaching her about digital transformations, which, any way you slice it, is child abuse. And that's all I need to talk about for myself today. Back once upon a time in 2012, the world was a very different place. There were a lot of reasons to avoid going single cloud, and they weren't wrong. I suggested a lot of them myself. For example, what if your cloud provider goes out of business? What then? You need to be able to pivot to something else. What if they add a zero to the end of price tags and suddenly nothing is economical and you've got to get out just from an economic point of view? And what if people get upset because they've been automated out of a job in your data center? These were valid concerns, but by and large, they didn't tend to happen. I mean, and there were some exceptions. For example, Verizon Public Cloud announced that they were going to take a short maintenance window. And by short, they meant 48 hours. It turned out that at first, their customers were really upset. And then they weren't their customers anymore. Today, Verizon has no public cloud. So if that was the single provider you went on, I'm sorry, you bet on the wrong horse. And it turns out that historically, prices tend to go one direction, down, not up, with the somewhat singular exception of the Google Maps API increasing its price by a lot last month. We need not comment on that, except I already did. And it turns out that being automated out of a job isn't the reason that I got fired. I'm not quite sure what was, but that's okay. Introspection isn't really my strong suit. Now, you might think that I'm talking about the past, that this isn't something that's relevant today. And you might be right, to a point. I write a sarcastic newsletter every week. And late last year, I put out a reader survey, and roughly 1,000 people were silly enough to respond. And I asked them what they used to provision infrastructure, primarily in AWS. 43% of people said CloudFormation, which is Amazon's native offering in this. That I don't need to joke on that, it writes its own punchline. 41% of people used Terraform. And one of the big reasons they suggested that was because it was for multi-cloud compatibility. It was really neck and neck. And to be very fair, there is no wrong answer here. If you talk to other people, like Cloudability, they ran a survey that show a majority of companies are in more than one cloud. So what am I talking about? Why would I be anti going into multiple providers, since it seems like that is not the direction that the industry is going in? These numbers don't say what people want them to say, and they don't say what they look like at first glance. I have examples. When a company says that they are multi-cloud, what do they mean? I mean, we have a vision in our head of them being able to apply whatever they're doing and deploy it seamlessly everywhere. If you take a look at the bill, though, it doesn't work out that way. It's normally one primary cloud and then a single-digit percentage of something else. That's something that we're seeing almost entirely industry-wide. There are exceptions, but there aren't many. Here's a more realistic example. This is the ridiculous architecture that I use to build my newsletter. I'm not kidding. It is entirely within AWS. I would consider myself an AWS customer. I have no cloud accounts with other providers. But by a lot of these numbers, I'm multi-cloud. I pay for Office 365 to install an Office suite on my laptop and my tablet because Amazon WorkDocs is a punchline that isn't funny. And I use G Suite or Google Apps for Domains or Gmail or whatever they're calling it this quarter to send email because Workmail from Amazon is even worse. And that counts as cloud revenue to both of those companies. For example, also, who here either they personally or as a company pays for GitHub? Yep, an awful lot of hands here. Are we taking any bets as far as what bucket that's going to go into next quarter once that acquisition closes? We are all Azure customers now. So why? Yay. Thank you, Captain Azure. So if nobody is doing this, why is everyone talking about multi-cloud? It's not inherently a terrible direction to go in, and the providers have to talk about it, because it turns out that very few companies are willing to either start fresh and build everything inside of a provider, or just pick up everything they've got and throw it into one. There's a migration process. Even pure greenfield projects have an awful lot of brown in them. Watch where you step. People aren't going to just one day do a knife switch cutover in most cases. There has to be a transition story, regardless of where you end up. And there are a number of companies here and projects that I have nothing against personally that, to some extent, need to be able to illustrate something of a multi-cloud story. Because if you go with a single provider and their maturity increases to a point where their internal tooling isn't terrible, there becomes fewer and fewer reasons to use a third-party vendor. And eventually, an awful lot of ecosystem companies will have nothing left to sell you. So that's where we are, but why is it terrible? For starters, you wind up finding yourself limited to the lowest common denominator of all the providers you want to use. And even now in 2018, that largely looks a lot like compute, storage, sort of a database, and the rest is pretty much load balancers. And everything else you're building on top of it rather than relying on primitives. Even the database story, other than its steady state, the APIs are different, the constraints are different, how things provision are different. You've got to build a shim in there that equates those things to one another. It's a problem. It's a lot of work. And as I mentioned in the keynote, we sell socks. Obviously, it's time for us to build all of our own stuff. There's not a lot of value here. In fact, it was humorous. Henning here in the audience wound up tweeting out after that, hey, well, we actually do sell socks and we do a lot of Kubernetes. The fun conversation that happened after that, I wound up excitedly showing him something that he was asking about, and it turned out that he wrote it. So I think we call that code-splaining. Let's also talk about data gravity, by which I mean that you generally tend to pick a primary provider that's where most of your data lives. If you have to spend an enormous pile of money to migrate data between providers, well, you're not saving any money by running your containers somewhere else. Does anyone here know what it costs to move 1 terabyte of data out of AWS into another provider? No, I don't. No one does. I'm not kidding. This is from the Open Guide to AWS. It's on GitHub. I'm the community lead. I helped build the latest version of this. This is the actual cost of data transfer in various scenarios within AWS. Nobody knows. I can figure it out, but I don't know. You can look at that in GitHub. I don't expect you to read and memorize all of that. There will be a quiz later. And there are also problems with moving large proportions of spend from one provider to another without warning. You ever met an accountant? Their least favorite word is surprise! And the reaction's about like that. Now, I will take questions later on, but I've given this talk a couple of times before, and people have come up with the same, now wait a second. So let's talk through some of those scenarios. For example, some people really like DynamoDB for a NoSQL data store. I don't tend to deal with stateful things because I'm not smart or good at things, but some people love it, so they want to have something that leverages that as a workload that lives in AWS. Okay, that's great. We love that. And a lot of people also enjoy that rush you get of never knowing whether that service that you're using from Google is about to be end-of-life, even though you're paying a lot of money for it. Adrenaline junkies, we do this. And I will say about Azure as well, that you are the only cloud provider that offers SLAs around individual instances. And I'll be honest, I don't know whether that's wonderful or terrific or horrible. And I'm not prepared to make a judgment on that, but we'll take it. It says interesting things about workloads. That's all I'm going to say there. And of course, what about wanting to run a commercial database where you have a non-trivial risk of being sued by your vendor? Because apparently, you know, you're born without the part of your brain that properly assesses business risk. Okay, great. These are individual workloads that you'd wind up putting in different providers, and I'm not opposed to that. What I'm talking about is the same workload being deployed to multiple places simultaneously. And if you put those individual workloads in different places, that's okay. I won't set you on fire for that. In fact, I'll help put you out. You're also going to potentially wind up seeing problems with your business strategy people as they say, wait, so we're going to award an enormous pile of money to a single vendor with no real strategy of being able to play them off against one another. There is validity to that. But if you really squeeze a vendor during negotiations, pie in the sky numbers, you might wind up getting an additional 5% off. Think of the time and effort that engineering is going to cost you, and exactly how long it's going to take to generate anything approaching a return on investment for that. It's a business decision. That's the CTO of Amazon and the president of AWS, and this is a common question. Well, what if Amazon, dun, 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 becomes a competitor? Yeah, Amazon's product strategy is yes, they're going to become your competitor. They're going to compete with everyone and everything until they are stopped. Look at Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, whatever pile of words in some sequence winds up providing Amazon's video service, is a direct competitor of Netflix. Netflix has made the decision to continue to do business with AWS as their cloud provider of choice. Everyone tends to do that to some extent. There's a trade-off in risk. You buy capability and you give up certain options. None of these things are irreversible. You can always change your mind later. But by and large, saying no doesn't, for reasons that may or may not manifest or apply to you, that's another business decision. And there's also the question of what happens 5 years from now when if the provider that we pick has to migrate, does something that we don't like, and strategically we are forced to migrate. You have a choice. You can try to build a level of agnosticism into your systems, but it's like a DR plan. If you don't practice it regularly, you wind up actually trying to execute the DR plan and falling flat on your face. If you don't ever test being able to deploy to another provider, and then 5 years from now, because you've theoretically written everything in an agnostic way, you will be able to migrate to that new provider like a bird into a window. It's never as simple as you think it's going to be, and there are always shades of nuance that mean this is an ongoing project. Now, I do wind up getting questions in this talk that discuss, well, what are valid use cases for this? What about, and people have said things, and yes, that's a great question. There are valid use cases for this. What I'm talking about here is the idea of a best practice, or as I like to think of it, a sensible default position. If you have a nuanced reason why your company needs to be able to deploy to multiple cloud providers simultaneously, great, terrific. You've put thought into it, you've made a decision, and you're heading in that direction. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, well, I read this thing in Gartner that says that we should absolutely be able to deploy to multiple providers all the time. And that study got slapped into the in-flight magazine that our CIO reads, so guess what we're doing? That's how strategy decisions get made, there and on the golf course. Take PagerDuty. They're here sponsoring. Everyone knows who PagerDuty is. They call you at 3 a.m. when your site catches fire. There is a validity there in that when you're going to get woken up because a provider is down, the thing that wakes you up needs to be more reliable than the provider that it runs on, if that provider matters. And yes, I've talked to people at PagerDuty. They are multi-cloud for the thing that wakes you up. That doesn't mean everything that they build, every workload lives there. Their marketing site, their onboard user experience, if their primary provider is down and everything's on fire, people will still get woken up, but they don't need to change the theme of their dashboard or, ooh, can we upload our corporate logo? Now is not the time to do that. Now everything's on fire and the internet is broken. Some people have business deals with larger customers than their companies who don't want to have their workloads on certain providers. You have to meet your customers where they are. If you have a large deal that says, okay, but you can't put it on that one cloud provider, there's not a great series of answers to that. And there's also geographical requirements. If you're in Europe, for example, there are data residency requirements in the form of things like GDPR. As these regulations tend to increase, you have to be able to deploy things in certain regions, and not all cloud providers have things there. If you're in the United States, absolutely none of that applies to you, because our politicians are bought and paid for. And of course, if you're trying to conduct business in mainland China, the punchline has been censored by the government, so I can't say it. But you're going to have to figure out how to address those needs, and a lot of times for things like this, you do need to go with multiple providers. But to do this, understand that when you start saying that we want to be able to go with multiple providers at any given point in time, you are buying a capability, you're buying optionality, and the coin that you pay for that in is how quickly you're able to iterate. You're having to take on a lot of undifferentiated heavy lifting in order to do it. I'm not suggesting which cloud provider you should use. I don't work for any of them. I'm self-employed. I'm not selling anyone, any particular vendor here. What I'm selling is the idea that you should be intentional about what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. So I contend that going all in on one provider, whatever that provider is a generally decent starting point to go with. And most providers will absolutely agree with you, provided you pick theirs. Well, you're gonna go with the other one? Let's talk about multi-cloud. And now we're back having that conversation. Like I mentioned at the keynote at the beginning of this, it comes down to context of understanding what's right for you and why you need to do the things that you do from a business reason for the right reasons. I do have two things to sell you that are free. I guess I'm giving them to you. If you enjoy my sense of humor, first, I'm sorry. Secondly, I write a weekly newsletter called Last Week in AWS. It gathers the news from Amazon's ecosystem, discards the crappy parts that no one cares about, which is most of it, and then makes fun of whatever's left. The other thing that's less sarcastic and a little more insightful is I talk to smart people a lot, and this is in the form of my podcast called Screaming in the Cloud. This week, funny enough for SREcon, my guest was Alex Seligman, who is the VP of Developer Relations at Google. We talk about a variety of different things that are relevant to some people, less relevant for others. It's not provider-centric. It is anything involving the business of cloud. In fact, if you folks know someone I should talk to, please let me know. And now it's time for Q&A. What did I get wrong? What use cases didn't I think of? I promise not to make fun of you. Go ahead.
Lies.
So there is two topics, but I only come with one. Data gravity.
Yes.
And this is, for example, also a case for us. So like depending on where you are, like you will have multi-cloud set up because data lives in one cloud and maybe also in the other, and it doesn't make sense to transfer things around. Because you didn't list it in your valid use cases.
Yes, there is the data lake story in that when you wind up accumulating things, if you have several data ponds, one big data lake, if you screw it up halfway and build a data swamp and take out a village, that tends to wind up dictating where things go. But generally speaking, with big data, machine learning, any sort of large scale analysis, where your data is generally going to dictate this. The success of those projects is based almost entirely on how much data you can throw into them, and moving exabyte scale things between providers generally doesn't happen. If you're in a position where you are consuming a lot of data into different providers, you're pretty much likely to leave that where it is, and that's not a terrible decision. The question then becomes architecturally, does it make sense to do that data intake and store them in a variety of providers, or does routing that back to from ingestion point to a centralized location make sense? And maybe that centralized place is a SAN. I'm not going to argue that you have to go all cloud all the time. It's, again, sensible defaults and best practices. Wow, you're a shy group. No one's even going to heckle, my God. Wow, that never happens.
Oh, sorry. You're not quite safe yet. Kieran's coming up.
Wonderful.
What changes can you envisage that might invalidate your argument?
That's a really good question. If data transfer from one provider to another became free, we also see, for example, that VMware and AWS struck a partnership at the beginning of this week. You can now, for example, run RDS on-prem inside of VMware. When the cloud starts to lose its borders and cross over into other providers, that very well could change it. If magically there were a common API that all of these providers agreed to speak, picture like a version of OpenStack that wasn't a terrible disaster tire fire, and you're sort of there. I suppose Amazon buys all of its competitors, because why not? They sit in the throne of money. I mean, there's theoretically that option. But by and large, I'm not seeing too many likely things that change this. And again, for those watching in the future in video, this is 2018. We could all be sitting here in 2020 laughing at this going, he totally didn't see it coming. And I accept that. I'm not claiming to be able to predict the future. I'm talking about now. But great question. No one's ever asked that one before.
Talking about the future, what about acquisitions and like the general trend with Kubernetes to have like higher level abstractions? And what I see is, I mean, there's a general rule with a certain size of an organization, you barely find every technology and every cloud provider in there, right? Because whatever, you have acquisitions, you have your own like different data centers, whatever. Mm-hmm. So isn't this kind of maybe a trend to barely force orgs to have a kind of this abstraction, and on the long run, if this abstraction is open source, actually to have this cohesion to maybe multi-cloud by default, because actually big orgs have this set up and this will not go away, right? They will not just move everyone in one cloud if they acquire businesses.
No, it's a good question. In fact, there's two parts to it that I'll dissect. One of them is the idea of acquisitions. You have giant companies that acquire different groups who have built out their infrastructure on certain providers. I would classify that almost definitionally as different workloads, and I would argue that there needs to be a compelling reason to change that. I was at a startup that got acquired by a company that was heavily into on-premise work. So what would it take to move out of a large cloud provider into something on-premise? And the answer was, well, you made a four after everyone quits. It felt at that point like it would be moving back in time in some respects, but there may have been a valid business reason to do it. As far as Kubernetes goes, I try to take a bit of a longer view. I think that we're seeing what we know of Kubernetes today feels to me like a transitional stage. We saw this with configuration management, where you're going to be configuring these things and systems are getting faster and better all the time, and then the world shifted towards the idea of immutable infrastructure. Containers were a great story for that for a while. Everyone was excited about Docker, 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 Docker. In fact, I could give an entire 5-minute lightning talk where nothing but the word Docker is said. And people would give me a standing ovation. back 5 years ago. Today, that isn't really interesting. Now we're talking about the orchestration layer of what goes into it with Kubernetes. And right now, I've got to say, there is a tremendous level of complexity that gets baked into Kubernetes and gets abstracted away. And it's almost like today, virtually no one cares about what operating system they're running under the hood. Eventually, these things all get subsumed away from the shiny thing we're looking at, and they become plumbing, things that underlie the rest of what we're trying to do. I don't think 10 years from now, anyone is going to care about a talk where someone gets on stage and talks about how they orchestrate containers or how they deploy workloads in highly available, highly scalable ways given some particular tool. I don't know what we're going to be talking about in 10 years. If I did, I would make large bets about it, or I would make incredibly confident-sounding statements that no one would remember to check me on if I got it wrong, but I look visionary if I get it right. So, good question.
So, I'm not entirely convinced that your statement about the wearing of a tie while coding is entirely data-driven, mm-hmm. but what sartorial science can you offer me that might change my mind?
Good question. It's not really data driven, it's data chauffeured. Yes, exactly. You have a bunch of people in it at once, and oh dear, we just reinvented the bus from first principles, and I think I was just thrown under it. There we go. There are a few hands as well. Yay, people have questions. You woke up. Oh, good.
So I recognize this may not apply to most customers of cloud services, but beyond a certain size, the price is not the price. Mm-hmm. And if you are in multiple providers, the nice salespeople start telling you that if you can do certain things or move certain load to them, you get more discounts. Mm-hmm. Does that factor into the, do you think that's a meaningful, does that have a meaningful impact on your assessment that this is
in isolation? No. Combined with other things, possibly. If it gets you a 5% discount at that point, if you're talking about $100 million in spend one way or another, knocking $5 million off of it is nothing to sneeze at. But at that scale, generally you will spend many times that in engineering effort if it hasn't been baked in already. So you're going to be talking about having to spend a tremendous amount of time re-engineering and re-architecting for that scenario, with the follow-on that it's not just the cost of people, there's an opportunity cost, because while people are doing that, they're not going to be able to focus on, you know, things that the business cares about as a business. Developing new features, expanding into new markets, crushing things as they become increasingly a juggernaut, et cetera, whatever it is that company's on board with. Great question. You had a hand, or?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, good. Have a microphone.
Thank you. Are you potentially suggesting about data transfer being free that potentially the disrupting business case would be that, I'll say Azure or GCP will offer you 9 cents a gigabyte if you move your data in, as opposed to free ingress, free ingress and charged egress, that it's discounted ingress?
Yes. At scale, again, as I mentioned, the price is never the price. If it's cool, I want to wind up moving some data over, oh, what does it cost? Ingress is free. Well, the counter argument there is, okay, well, how much are you moving? An exabyte. Oh, dear. And there, it's the storage charges once it gets there that winds up being a challenge. And in some specific cases, certain cloud providers will offer, if they're trying to seize an account, they'll do things such as discount or even give away or refund the egress charge to bring something over in some cases. I mean, people will strike interesting deals on this, but it always comes with some form of commitment. Nothing is free. There's always a story of, okay, in return for signing this contract, getting this level of commitment, building out something. And that winds up shaping a lot. That becomes a very nuanced conversation, but if we break it down to the sort of simple thing that applies to the general case, I don't think it applies to most environments unless there's something very special going on in the broader industry, and I don't see any signs of that right now. Great question, though.
How does things like AWS Lightsail kind of change the economics? I mean, they're pretty obviously like going after DigitalOcean, but that's much lower level than normal.
No, Lightsail, for those who aren't familiar, is a fixed rate VPS style offering that is a fixed fee for a month. You get a certain amount of data transfer, you get a certain amount of capacity, and it's flat rate. And from my position, Lightsail is there to taunt us. and remind us of a world that could have been but wasn't, where a pricing model was easily understood, where you paid X dollars a month for things and didn't want to need a degree in applied mathematics to figure out what the hell you were just charged for. And as much as I like it, I don't see people deploying it at large scale. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's easy to understand. It's the antithesis of virtually everything else AWS does. Oh, we have a new service. We'd like to show you it. We're just going to assume that you know the 18 other services that you need to have at least a passing familiarity with in order to understand what this one does. I'm a little bitter, you might tell, you might notice.
So a slightly dystopian version of this feature would be that as companies become more and more cloudified and deploy more and more cloud, eventually there is a point of vendor lock-in where people have deployed in the various cloud providers, but now they have deployed, and because the migration is so expensive, as you pointed out, the next logical step for the cloud providers is to significantly increase their prices to find the point at which the customers are still willing to pay, because it's still cheaper than doing the actual migration to a potentially cheaper competitor. Can you comment on that?
Yes. I mean, there are a few ways economically that could play out. My preferred vision of that, if one provider, and it would be one provider unless we're talking about a cartel-style situation, where one provider in isolation raises prices and suddenly it first serves as a cautionary tale for new companies that are started to not pick that provider. It would almost be a slit-your-own-throat style of situation. There are also, in any of these large, sizable accounts that we're talking about, there's a locked-in pricing structure that extends for a period of years. And it's, oh, in 4 years when this contract runs out, prices are going to multiply by 10. Well, guess what just moved up the roadmap, folks? And at that point, there will be enough of an outcry, I would imagine, for things to wind up playing out. I'm not going to take the naive approach of saying, oh, companies would never do that. Why would they? It would only inflate this quarter's numbers. And companies want to take the long view and be good stewards of the massive resources and trust placed in them. Yeah, I live on Earth. I have to think that there's enough of a competitive advantage today where that would be incredibly foolish. This is one of the reasons I fear any one provider becoming almost a monoculture in this space. It's a great question. I don't think it's a concern for today, but it very well may be down the road. That's the optionality. Well, 5 years from now, we may have to migrate. What I would encourage people to do if they're starting to think in that direction is not necessarily not to go in on a single provider, but if there are things that only one provider has, for example, a globally distributed database that works a certain way with certain guarantees, and that's what your architecture is built on, that's a conceptual lock-in. It's not a, well, the load balancer works a little differently, so it takes more work. That's a, we have to rebuild our entire application to migrate it off. That's a strategic choice I would still urge people to make cautiously. That said, everyone seems to be coming out with a globally distributed database, so we'll see how compatible they are once they stop announcing and start, you know, releasing.
So you countered my Kubernetes question with nobody cares about how to run containers, and I would agree. But I think like the benefit of Kubernetes is kind of the more or less de facto API, which is not like a real path, right? But it's the first time there is this kind of this alignment across cloud providers that developers have one API they can deal with. So even if this container runtime is completely hidden, like with Fargate, and then with Kubernetes API, you have this accumulated knowledge with engineering, and you mentioned engineering effort. So wouldn't this be a pressure factor for like providers to actually offer this standardized API and make this multi-cloud attractive again, because all the engineers have this knowledge and they are kind of trained and will only work with what they know about. Right now it's the Kubernetes, and right now it's AWS API to know, in the future maybe something higher level.
I think that in many cases, containers themselves are not necessarily an endgame. And we take a look now at the functions as a service offerings, such as AWS Lambda, Azure Functions, Google Cloud Functions, et cetera. I may be pronouncing some of those wrong. And at that point, we're almost post-container with those things. Well, they run in containers-ish. Well, okay, great, but you throw code over the wall and someone else runs it for you. Some would argue that if you're just writing the code, there's no lock-in at all. Other people would say it's a massive amount of lock-in based upon how that gets expressed. Today, serverless is largely a toy for many workloads. I think 3 years from now, that will be a very different story. At which point, when does Kubernetes and container-based workloads become tomorrow's legacy technology? And that's going to be an interesting question. It's a question of how far out in the future we want to look at. By the time I retire, or more likely get murdered to death by an audience someday when I make a joke that doesn't land well, then I think that we're going to be talking about very different things by then, and I'm going to look back at recordings of this and laugh. Laugh and laugh. Oh, absolutely. Maybe we may be using OpenFast, maybe using something else beyond that. It's really a question of how the industry goes. I didn't predict Docker. I didn't predict Kubernetes. I certainly didn't predict serverless. And okay, I don't know. It turns out I'm really bad at predicting the future. Who knew?
Never predicted that.
Good. There we go.
Do we have time for one more?
Shouldn't we cut some slack to newer cloud providers? Because if we keep just using those four, okay, maybe Oracle a bit, we will end up in a few years from now just our data just being owned by four, five providers, and instead of governments asking the service we were using, they were just asking straight away Amazon for the whole, every data that was on a specific server. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we be a little bit less judgy with their bumpy starts? And we are not the only ones that we are testing in production and fixing stuff. They are doing that as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe if we try their products, they will become eventually better. We will suffer a bit, but mm-hmm. You see my point.
No, you're absolutely right. There are many more vendors other than the four I've thrown up there. Well, three serious ones and one for laughs. But the challenge, too, is that there's a difference between, I guess, tier one providers and, I guess, tier two, tier three, et cetera. And for most large enterprises making serious multi-million-dollar investments, there is a certain reluctance in a vacuum to wind up going with an up-and-comer. There's a concern in many aspects of business where you don't necessarily want to be a vendor's biggest customer. And in some cases where it's, okay, so I'm working with a startup, great, I'm 80% of their revenue. Well, that's a business risk for one, and in many cases, the answer becomes instead, well, we'll just buy them. And then at that point, you effectively wind up with your own private cloud that is run by, until what was very recently, a respectable tier two or tier three provider. You're right as well with the idea that all data becomes centralized to certain providers. That's why encryption at rest, a solid KMS strategy, winds up becoming critically important for this. It also helps to have a strong regulatory framework in the jurisdictions in which these companies operate. These are big concerns, a little out of scope from a cloud agnosticism perspective, but this is the sort of stuff that keeps me up at night. I lead a weird life. Are we out of time?
I think so.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you all very much for your time and for putting up with us.